The opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Fun, the For Us Network.
Please fasten your seatbelts.
Hello and welcome to Suck It to Politics. I'm Ed the Suck. Joining me today, as usual, Samantha Eamon in Toronto. Hello, Sam.
Hey, guys.
Hafiz Nirani in Vancouver. Hello, Hafiz.
Hello, hello.
And Aaron Seal in Montreal. Hello, Aaron.
Bonjour. Hello, everyone.
All right. So today we're going to talk about, up first, is the economic statement put forward by Chrystia Freeland this week in the House of Commons. It outlines spending for family, for youth, for the RCMP, green initiatives, long-term care, taxing Netflix, and then another $30 billion in stimulus for when this whole nonsense ends. Lots to talk about there. I sort of see this as the, well, what the hell else are we supposed to do economic statement? Because no matter who is in government now, you'd be pretty much in a straitjacket as far as what you can and can't do. So let's see what everybody else's opinions are. I'll start with Sam. Sam?
Well, I'm actually looking forward to the conversation with you guys, and I'll actually start by asking a question because economics is not my strong suit. So what I want to know what you guys think is the most important point to come out of this statement.
Interesting question. Aaron Seal, your thoughts.
I will say, Sam, that if you're asking that question, that means Chrystia Freeland missed the mark, because when you put out an economic statement or a budget or whatever you want to call it, the headline item should grab attention. So, Ed, if your question is what the hell else are we supposed to do, that in my mind is a failure of the conservative side, because Aaron O'Toole and Pierre Poilievre and the rest of them should have answered that question. And Sam, the question of what are we supposed to be looking at? Well, if I look at this economic statement, and if I look at page 123, for example, if I look at the numbers, we are facing a deficit of $381 billion. But the new additions to the fiscal plan in this economic statement, it's the third line on this page, it's only about $25 billion. So the proportion of new action in this plan compared to steady as she goes is quite minimal. And if you look at the details, you've got increases to child supports for families with young children, and you've got environmental measures. You talk about planting trees. These are not the things that are going to save our recovery. The headline items of the Liberal government strategy, as we know, are one, getting a vaccine into people's arms, and two, supporting our economy through the period which we have left until a vaccine is ready and distributed, and then supporting growth to bring us back to normal. This economic statement doesn't add a lot of meat to the plan, and it'll be very interesting to see going forward if we can create real fuel for economic growth to bring us back to where we need to be, because we don't have a plan for that yet.
Well, it's kind of hard to make a plan for that when we're not even there yet. We don't even know what it's going to look like. We don't know what the landscape's going to look like when this is all said and done. And we're talking about a budget that doesn't, or an economic statement that doesn't add a lot of new spending, but the spending that's already been done. How much more can we really add? It's really a tough position to be in, no matter who's in government. This is a lousy thing. You know, if we were fighting a war, a physical war with an enemy like the Nazis, then people would be less concerned about how much we're spending and more concerned with winning the war.
But because we'd have bonds. We'd have war bonds by now. Imagine if we had COVID bonds right now.
That would be an interesting idea. A little late for that now, though. And the supports for family, well, really, it's kind of peanuts. It's $120, four payments of $300 for kids under six if you make under a certain amount of money per year. It's nice, but how much does it really do? And, the green initiative, the big item there that jumped out at me was up to five grand in grants if you qualify for turning your house more energy efficient, which I think a lot of people will jump at, because energy efficiency is the kind of thing that benefits the homeowner long-term. Hell, I'd like to know how much it's going to cost to put the solar panels on the top of my roof, even though those things are damn ugly. Why has nobody found a way to make solar panels better looking? They look so damn ugly.
The Europeans have pretty nice looking ones, actually.
Oh, do they?
Yeah, like they have entire roofs now that are designed to be the solar panel, so it doesn't look like you've added solar panels. The roof is a solar panel.
Yeah, but that's kind of expensive. I'm just wondering,
like, with the conservatives complaining about how much money's been spent and the amount of deficit that we've been going into, I mean, maybe Aaron can talk a bit more to this, but what was our alternative in terms of spending on aid for COVID and things like that? Like, what was
doing nothing? Look.
That's the problem with conservative perspectives right now. It's that there's a lot of criticism, but there's not a lot of innovative thought and alternatives being proposed. If you look at the conservative platform for the last election, we remember what the conservatives were proposing. It was thin gruel at best. You had Pierre Poilievre coming out on the day the platform was released saying we're proposing a faster path to eliminating deficits and to restoring surpluses, but his plan for doing that was heavy on delayed infrastructure spending. That doesn't benefit anyone. Now, Pierre Poilievre is out talking about the need for tax simplification and regulatory reform, which is the type of thing he should have been doing when he was appointed finance critic 3 years ago. Now, what we should be proposing, and what I would hope Aaron O'Toole and the stronger members of his team are going to be promoting, is meaningful contributions to economic growth. He has talked about things like manufacturing capacity, about restoring our ability to make stuff ourselves rather than buying it overseas. That's the type of thing, if you get into details about the types of projects that could be supporting economic growth, about the locations of economic growth, about diffusing economic growth across the country, and creating meaningful sources to create that growth practically, those are the types of things which I would hope finance critics from opposition parties would be promoting. But as long as you see Pierre Poilievre doing the types of things he should have been doing when we were in good times, and Aaron O'Toole choosing to engage Freeland's rhetoric rather than getting into meaningful policy alternatives that are being ignored, we're all going to be spinning our wheels until we've got meaningful, innovative thought. And I haven't seen that in reaction to the economic statement.
I would say, in terms of where Freeland's at, I mean, this is now, what, the third economic update of some sort that we've gotten this year because of COVID. I mean, we had the budget at the beginning of the year with Morneau. Then we had the reset with another sort of budgetary statement. And now a couple months later, or a month later, we've got another economic statement. I don't think anyone should really expect anything in this other than an update. And the reason we need an update is because spending is going crazier than usual because of the pandemic. Now, you'll hear conservatives complain across the board about our spending. But in terms of how we're going about it, this has really benefited us because all that money does one thing. It goes to people that put it back into the economy. Now, granted, billionaires have also gotten richer in Canada during the pandemic, but that comes from not spending money mostly and holding on to it. And the other aspect of this is, conservatism today focuses on one thing, and that's austerity, and that's not spending a dime and just letting it be stagnant and slow. What we result in is looking at exactly what's happening in sort of Texas right now, where you have mile-long lineups of cars and multiple lanes lining up for a bag of food to take home and feed their families. That's the reality we would have in Canada right now without a Liberal government and with a Conservative government in power. Why? Because Conservatives do not care about people. They care about balanced books.
I have to disagree, and I'll let you talk in a sec, Sam. I think that no matter who was in power, we would have had something called something like CERB. We would have had supports.
Not at all.
Oh, not, we would have, for sure. For
the
sure.
Conservatives are against CERB.
They've no, they're a, not. They're
yes,
against,
they are.
They're against CERB fraud.
No.
They were not against CERB.
No.
Conservatives being have come against, out and said...
Presenting CERB fraud is a classic tactic of bashing things like CERB so they do not happen. I guarantee you, we would not be in a position with any money from the Conservative government, because the Conservative government follows the same policies as the Conservative government in the UK, as well as Republicans in the USA, which is one standard thing. Fuck the poor.
Well,
no,
what,
you know what?
I agree.
Sorry. Hold on. when Harper, who was very much against deficits, was faced with the 2008 meltdown, he did something that was non-conservative. He went into deficits and invested in stimulus. And that's what would have happened this
into
time
corporations.
Around.
Yeah, so money would go to corporations. Companies, yeah. Great. Bell Canada gets more money while every one of their employees sits at home
and
starves.
I don't think any party would have let Canadians starve. Sam, you wanted to say something then, Aaron.
The one party would let Canadians starve. It's the Conservative Party of Canada that always lets Canadians starve.
Bringing up the point of pandemic profiteering is very important. I know this is something Jagmeet Singh has been talking about a lot. And it's a real thing. I mean, Amazon, the up in profits, and I'm sorry if I'm using the wrong terminology, like this is not my strong suit at all, but why aren't we doing something about the fact that all these companies are making so much more money, but we're not seeing any benefit from it?
It should be like war profiteering. If you're profiteering,
it is. It's exactly what it is.
It's not like war profiteering. More people are using the service. They provided a service that happened to be well positioned for what's happening now.
They're raising the prices of these services.
And I still get my Amazon Prime for the same amount of money, and I get free delivery.
We're not talking about Amazon. We're talking about the entire economy. There is profiteering going off. All one has to look at is the bank accounts of the people higher up that have made $37 billion.
A lot of money off this.
Yeah.
They're not raising their prices they just happen to be services that were well in place when this thing happened, and more people then wind up using the service. If all of a sudden cars,
Amazon has raised the price of goods on Amazon basically, and they say it's on demand, but it doesn't go based on demand. It goes based on the fact that people are going to pay for this and they know they can get a lot more money out of them.
That's called demand.
And Hafiz's point about SERB fraud, and I'm glad he brought it up because I think it's idiotic. Like the kind of hype and fear mongering going on about voter fraud in the States, SERB fraud, like I hate to say it, but I don't give a shit about it. And here's why. We got money out to the people who needed it as quickly as we could, which is what we needed to do. The amount of SERB fraud is negligible in terms of compared to how much money we had to get out as quickly as we could to the number of people. This is not a real thing. This is a conservative hype up. It's like it's a conservative fear-mongering thing to say, well, SERB just gives money to people who don't want to work. And I don't think that's true at all.
And if you look at the percentage, it works out to less than what? Less than 1% of SERB applicants that could have been fraud. And the other aspect is the CRA knows all these people's accounts. You have to give in so much information to get SERB. To think that it's not coming with a clawback and a smack in the face to those that abused it, you have something else coming.
And we're all going to be taxed out the nose next year.
I think that when all is said and done, the greatest percentage of people who got SERB and shouldn't have were people who were confused about whether they were eligible, not people who deliberately defrauded anything.
Exactly.
Aaron, you wanted to speak. Please do.
Yeah, so I'll first respond to, Ed, what you said about Harper in 2008, how he chose to take an unconservative response. What I'll say is it's important to acknowledge the diversity of opinion among conservatives. There are absolutely conservatives that would have been quite happy having no CERB, saying if you're in trouble health-wise or economically, it's up to you to deal with it. And I'm not one of them. And I know a lot of others who aren't one of them, but unfortunately those voices do get heard. And it's up to the leadership of the leading conservative party to create a plan that responds to reality, quite frankly, while also keeping the base happy. So I won't deny that there are some conservatives who are unhappy that they're footing the bill through the state for CRB at all, but I would object to framing that as the mainstream opinion. And as you say, Ed, Harper and Jim Flaherty and the conservative cabinet chose to embrace stimulus in 2008, 2009 because it was necessary. And I choose to believe that a conservative government, if a conservative government were in power right now, would do the same thing. I don't think it's the time, as Sam was suggesting, to in any way sort of crack down on corporations. And you guys talked about Amazon. The one thing that comes to mind for me when I think about Amazon right now is this million square foot new facility that they're building in Ottawa right now, that you can literally see being erected in Ottawa right now, which is the type of thing that represents real economic growth. That facility will move products, that facility will employ people, and that facility will contribute to Canada's economic prosperity. And that's the type of thing we need. If I remember the discussions that happened behind the scenes in the years 2009, 2010, 2011, when I was working for Jim Flaherty at the time, and I was watching the economic recovery occur behind the scenes, you need to get into the details of things like factories. We are talking about automotive factories. We are talking about reinforcing the aerospace industry, the airlines, and these are the things that we need to be thinking about. Now, the focus right now from a management perspective, if I'm putting on the hats of the ministers within the Trudeau government, is first and foremost vaccine strategy, and that's how it has to be. And there is some discussion of vaccine strategy in the economic statement. It's actually right at the front. You compare Canada's plans for vaccine procurement with other countries. And if you get into the details of that, there's really some detailed conversations that need to be had on that. Because if you look literally at the graphic in the economic statement, it's promoting the fact that Canada has made plans with more suppliers to procure more vaccines than other countries. That reflects strategic underpinnings that are debatable. Should we be broadening our vaccine basket? And as we've read in the news, putting ourselves behind other countries whose companies and factories are going to be the ones producing it, obviously they're going to put themselves first. We don't have the same manufacturing capacity, so we've had to take a broader strategy. And that has pros and cons. Those are the types of debates we should be having. But debates over headline deficits or not, that reflects the fact that this economic statement is pretty much steady as she goes from a strategic perspective. And the headline discussion of deficits too high or not, that's not going to restore our economic growth. We need to get into the details, and I worry that that's not happening.
You know, the thing that worries me is the $30 billion over 3 years to restart the economy. And here's why it worries me, because we saw over the summer when the lockdowns were relaxed and things returned to midway between normal and not normal, that the economy bounced back. The economy was resilient and the economy bounced back. So I'm thinking, well, why do we need $10 billion over 3 years, or $30 billion over 3 years, $10 billion a year to rebuild an economy that showed resilience and an ability to bounce back? So my fear is, what is it they're seeing that we're not seeing yet? What is still to come on the economic front? How many more bankruptcies, how many more businesses are they expecting to go belly up over the next little while that they think that this much stimulus is necessary? That's a concern.
And that's exactly it. We've got to be looking forward at what the risks that remain in the economy are. And I'm thinking personal bankruptcies. I'm thinking small business bankruptcies. And I'm looking at the housing market. In my mind, those are the three things that are on my mind. There may well be others. But if I think about the effect that this pandemic has had on the economy, there's a lot of people who are generally okay. And we see some news stories saying there are some people who've even been made slightly better off at the lower incomes, given the stimuluses that have been available. But the people that have been hard hit, I'm thinking small business owners, I'm thinking families that may have come into the pandemic already stretched beyond their means, I'm thinking people who've borrowed a little too hard against their properties. These people have been treading water through the pandemic, but they're very nervous because they see the road ahead. And if I think about what triggered the declines in 2008, the subprime housing market and the U.S. financial institutions that instantly saw their operations turned on their heads because their portfolios were no longer worth what they thought they were going to be, that people were talking about this for a few years before 2008, but it happened really quickly. So I agree, Ed. This economic statement is very glossy. There's a lot of charming rhetoric to make it seem like we're okay. But I think there are real risks in the economy that are just being consciously ignored that we need to be taking a lot more seriously.
Well, I think that stimulus money is them telling us, sort of telegraphing, shit's going to hit the fan, Sam.
Yeah, I'm glad we finally brought up, like, the people that are actually going to be most affected by this. I'm glad they're, you know, they're injecting money into the economy, but let's not forget the people that this pandemic has already affected. And it's more people like renters who couldn't get rent relief. That's something that on a national scale, I know it's more provincial, but on a national scale, people need more rent reliefs than they're getting. And I know that sounds like, oh, spend more money. But there are people who are actually on the street because of this pandemic. And the more people we put out of housing is the more stress on social services that can't handle it. That's more stress on hospitals. Like, we're complete, again, and Hafiz said it, like, we're forgetting about the poor. And we're forgetting about the fact that there's people who have already been impacted to a point where an economic stimulus doesn't really do anything for them because they don't have a roof over their heads. They're not able to feed themselves.
If you look at going back to Ed's point on what's happening with the economy and what do they not know, I mean, just look around. I don't know what it's like in Toronto, but I mean, if I go around Surrey or Vancouver, there's a bunch of small businesses that aren't there anymore. And just on another note, like if you look at how many people that are millennials or Gen Zs that have now moved back with their parents because they can't afford rent because there isn't a job that's regular to go to. And I mean, even with a CERB of $2,000 a month, that in Vancouver, like $1,500 is what it costs to rent a one bedroom apartment.
Yep, I'm so, in Toronto, it's the same.
And it, so, I mean, the money that a lot of people have gotten may have been enough for a couple expenses, but there's other expenses that people aren't spending on this year. I don't know how much people are going to spend on Christmas this year compared to years before.
Well,
that's going to be a good sign. That's of what's going to happen.
That's a fear that people are going to people have, because they say that a lot more people are going to be shopping online, but with people aren't getting together. I know that if I'm not getting together with people, there's people I buy presents for, only because I'm going to be getting together with them for the holidays. And if I'm not getting together with them, I'm not getting them presents. And I think that there's probably more people out there like me that are willing to admit. I do think, though, that the...
Who's not getting a present this year, Ed? Call them out.
You.
Oh.
But that was never in doubt. The interesting thing is money being spent for body cams for the RCMP, which I think is sort of long overdue.
Absolutely. I completely agree, Ed.
Do they turn off? That's the question. They shouldn't turn off. Yeah. It's nice to have body cams.
The thing I don't understand about body cams is do they then record everything the cops say to each other sitting there in a car waiting for shit to happen?
If they're on, yes. If the cop has turned them off, no.
Okay, but what about when they go to the bathroom?
Oh, yeah, loud subwoofer sounds there.
Yeah, like, are they allowed to turn them off for bodily functions?
I think when you're off duty, you're allowed to have it off. I mean, that's just, I think, something.
What about when you're making a duty? Are you allowed to turn it off?
Those are rules which any police management will have to define. So whether it's the RCMP at the federal level or the provincial police and municipal policing forces, everybody has their sets of rules. And some of them dictate when the cameras and audio recordings must be turned on. And in some jurisdictions, officers have some discretion to turn them off in some situations for a variety of reasons. In some cases, individuals can request that officers turn them off in certain situations and engagements. I agree, Ed, those are critical rules to get right on the management level. But I think we agree amongst ourselves that the idea of creating better evidence to hold officers accountable for their actions and choices is long overdue and will be critical in a variety of ways, including but not limited to reducing systemic racism in policing.
I think it also protects officers. I think it protects police too. Police should want them, because now it's not a, you know, who said what said, or just a clip from a phone camera that started to record only after an incident started and didn't record what led up to it. This is good for police and it's good for citizens as well. There's no losers with body cams except for lousy cops.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly disagree with you guys on the usefulness of body cams, because yeah, they can record whatever they want, but it has to come down to change within the organization and having body cams actually affect that change. And I don't think that the RCMP is ready to make the kind of systemic changes it needs to in order to address things like racism within the force and how they treat citizens. Like, they can record as much as they want, but we already know that officers are getting away with a lot of things. And those are things that we know about. And I don't see body cams as an effective cure for that, because we already know that officers are getting away with some shady stuff, but they're not doing anything about it. The RCMP will back their guys 100% of the time.
Until and there's evidence that they can't back
them. It doesn't matter.
If there's evidence there, listen.
There was evidence in Nova Scotia.
People behave differently when a camera's on. I can attest to that.
Yeah, but the RCMP has to actually do something about it, and they're not.
Once the stuff is released to the public, it winds up creating a bit of a firestorm. You can't, and it what it does is it eliminates the he said, she said, business of police, and it actually records stuff. I think that, listen, if I'm being recorded doing anything, I'm going to be a lot more conscious of what I do and what I say than if I'm not. So I think that it's absolutely a step in the right direction. Is it a panacea? No, what is? But it's a step in the right direction. And we need to keep taking steps in the right direction to eventually get to a goal. So I don't know, are you objecting to body cams?
I guess I'm not objecting to body cams specifically. What I'm saying is the RCMP needs to show the capability to follow up on things that happen. And they have since not, or has as of yet, have not shown their ability to do that.
It's more than just the cams. It's what you do with the cameras
exactly.
And the content
so
it captures.
It's the follow-up.
It's the accountability.
Yeah,
and like freedom of information.
You're going to suspend an officer with pay? Like, oh, great. That's punishing enough.
That's,
like,
that's a union thing, though. That's not a police thing.
Who gets the data? Like, I mean, are the police going to release the video of them abusing someone? Like, how hard is it going to be to get that? There's other things that need to be in place. Like, the camera footage on there should be accessible to people that demand it easier.
Well, it depends. See, there's where Aaron's talking about. Because some people who just got pulled over for a ticket or were talked to by police, they don't want other people being able to see them engaged with police.
Well, regarding your own case, you should be able to pull that in.
Regarding your own case, absolutely. I think it's interesting they're going to be finally taxing Netflix. I don't know how the hell Netflix, specifically Netflix, because it's the oldest one, but digital streaming services managed to get away without being taxed. Everything we have in this country is taxed. Every service is taxed. Somehow Netflix managed to get away without being taxed. It's not going to bring in a ton of money. I mean, over 5 years, they're expecting maybe $1.2 billion. When you're looking at the size of the Canadian economy, it's a bit of a piss in a bucket. But still, at least it's just as far as things being fair. I mean, cable's taxed. Everything is every entertainment is taxed. Why should this not be taxed? Thank God it's finally being taxed, just out of fairness.
Yeah, I just think it sets a good precedent. I think it hasn't been taxed so far. That's a mistake. And I like I get it. It's not going to bring in a lot of money, but it's showing that they're taking a step, because they've received, like, the government has received a lot of criticism for not taxing places like that. So I'm for it. Even if it does only bring in a minimal amount of money, it shows that they're willing to take a step to start.
Put it into Canadian media that's dying, not into media that's going to die no matter what. Because just
also
putting shoveling money into a media form that is badly managed and is not future proofing, that's a waste of money. But you know, $1.2 billion, it's not a lot when you look at the overall economy. But when you look at the amount of money that they could take and put that back into the ailing Canadian production community, that would be a lot of money, actually. Anyone else have anything else they want to say about the budget before we move on to the other story?
Yeah, I just want to add that I wouldn't be so quick to dismiss it as a low revenue measure, because if you look at chapter four of the budget and you look at the final table of the tax measures being proposed, it all told, both the digital tax, taxation of fulfillment warehouses, international corporate tax measures, tax compliance measures, we're looking at $7 billion in new tax revenues over 5 years. Through these types of so-called loophole measures, some of which legitimately deserve the title, some don't. But $7 billion in new taxes is not nothing. I agree that there's a case for taxation of digital media assets, and it has to be gotten right. But we need to look at the details on this sort of thing, because this type of thing will happen. It happened during the Harper era too. The one that sticks out in my mind was tobacco taxes. Governments, when they're facing large-scale deficits, will use them as cover for all kinds of little tax measures, and you need to look at them one by one, because not all of them are created equal.
The digital media tax is the right direction, as far as I'm concerned. There's a whole bunch of activity that happens in our economic sphere that goes without taxes, and the digital space has been a huge one for that. I mean, I can speak for this for myself. It's easy to set up a website and not charge tax and ship out products. And I think Netflix has gotten away with something, and I'm glad to see Canada is catching up with the reality of the world we live in.
Now, does this mean that websites now have to collect tax for? Well, when you sell on their website,
when you sell stuff on your website, you should be setting up proper taxing procedures, especially if you're setting that website up in Canada. If you're shipping in Canada and you're not collecting taxes, that's a bit of a no-no, and you might get a knock on your door in a couple months.
I don't think they actually come knocking on your door anymore.
No, they send people. No kidding, they don't send people. you got a call, not from India.
Yeah, that's right. All right.
Hello, we're the real CRA.
Yeah, send us money. We will leave you alone. All right. Speaking of India and Indian people, we're talking about Supriya Dwivedi. I think that's how you pronounce her name. Forgive me if I get it wrong, but she, up till this week, was a personality on Global News Radio based in Toronto. And she quit because she said that Corus, the owner of Global, was allowing too much misinformation, to especially about people of color and very different religious faiths, on their programs. And whenever she would go on and try to correct them from being, you know, inaccurate, she would get death threats. And so, I mean, Corus left it to her to be the only voice that was correcting all this bit of misinformation, race, let's call it what it is, racism against people. She was the only one who would stand up and correct it. And as a result, she's the one who got the shit. And so she quit. And Corus is saying, no, we respect the diversity, and we just can't police all the things that people say on our radio shows. And the CRTC would disagree with you. While you can't police what somebody says when they call in, you know, you have limited control over that. You can correct them when they've made a statement that's incorrect. And when your on-air hosts are saying things which are misleading and incorrect, somebody's got to take them out to the woodshed.
And you have a responsibility in that. Yeah. Like, I'm sorry. Like, if your hosts are spreading lies, then you have a responsibility as a broadcaster to correct that. And I think that is a thing that has been lost in our era right now of fake news. And I hate to say it, conservative pundits have been kind of at the forefront of this.
Well, Corus Radio, Global Radio, is a conservative bastion. They don't deny it. They affirm that they are largely, that their programs largely skew conservative. Talk radio skews conservative. That's not news. Because talk radio is based on people feeling aggrieved, and conservatives are the ones who largely feel loudly aggrieved these days. Thoughts about this? I'll go first to Aaron.
Well, first I'll say I'm disappointed that she quit. I'm disappointed that it got to the point where she'd want to, and I'm disappointed that she did. Because if you look at somebody who's strong enough to call this stuff out on the public stage, this is somebody who deserves a platform of the magnitude of a media major like Chorus, which she had. And it's not easy for minorities, particularly minority women, to get that type of platform. So I am disappointed. I understand why she felt compelled to withdraw from her position, but I'm disappointed because I'd rather she use that as a platform for change to draw attention to the problem rather than almost being silenced by it. But I will say beyond that, that what I'm reading is a perfect example of how institutional prejudice and systemic racism plays out within these types of major corporate environments. Because you see the leaders of these organizations and even the organizations themselves under their brands, they'll use the hashtags, they'll say things like Black Lives Matter and BIPOC Lives Matter, they'll promote verbally the importance of diversity, but when something real happens, I don't see on these types of racial prejudice issues the same type of meaningful inertia towards change that you see in other social causes. When people get called out on an individual basis saying you, the things you are doing, the behaviors you are exhibiting, the instincts you have are contributing directly or indirectly to systemic prejudice, people get their backs up and they say, no, it's not my problem. Look at me. I'm using the Black Lives Matter hashtag. I'm not the one contributing to this. And a lot of times that defensive instinct is part of the problem. So like I say, I wish the best for Ms. Dvedi. I hope she gets another platform and I hope she uses it to inspire change. But I think that in this moment, she is illustrating how institutional prejudice and systemic racism plays out in practice. I'll say one more thing before I hand it over to sales. I do think that you can't control your audience. When you call out racism, when you put yourself out there as a prominent minority voice, there are going to be some people who are going to be racist towards you. I've experienced this in politics myself. Sometimes it can get nasty. And for better or worse, you do have to have a thick skin and a stiff spine. I don't think that's right. I don't think that's how it should be. I do think there should be a willingness to have frank discourse. I think that some of the things that I've read that she's been exposed to cross the line, as I've seen in political advocacy myself. But I don't think that excuses the behavior. I just think that on some level, you have to sort of play it as it lies and expect that you're going to get those types of reactions. That said, I agree that her institution, in this case, Chorus, should be standing behind her and should be calling out the problem and reinforcing her position. I think it plays both ways, but I think that we should see this as an example of the reality of institutional prejudice and systemic racism as minorities live it on a daily basis.
All right, Sam, you wanted to say something?
Yes. Oh, I want to say a lot. So this is kind of in my house. So I kind of wholeheartedly disagree with Aaron a little bit, obviously not on the fact that it shows systemic racism.
Well, do you wholeheartedly disagree with him or do you kind of wholeheartedly disagree with him? Because you can't kind of wholeheartedly disagree.
Okay, it's early, goddammit, for me. But I disagree passionately, not wholeheartedly, passionately.
All right, that's all right. You can disagree. You can kind of disagree passionately.
Yeah, okay. So what I will say is that I don't think that having a stiff spine and a thick skin should be in any way talked about right now, because the amount, and I'll speak to this as a woman in a second. You know, there were rape threats for her. There were rape threats for her baby daughter. There were, even when she said she was quitting, people like Mark Emery.
The Prince of Pot?
Yes, the Prince of Pot himself.
Yeah.
Was talking about the fact that she was probably just a pain in the ass to work with and that she sees racism in everything, like the woman who reported on this, Manisha Krishnan, who I highly recommend reading her pieces on this, because this systemic racism issue and the the issue of the company not responding to its employees goes way back further and way deeper. This company has laid off directly a lot of people who have been vocal critics within the company.
Absolutely.
And this, so I think this goes a lot deeper than Supriya, and Supriya is just, I think she did the right thing. I think it was
Well, she had to make the right decision for herself. She made the right decision, and I think hatred and vitriol.
No one deserves to do that. I'll just speak to my personal experience here for a second. When I was putting out columns, when I produced a podcast, you can't imagine the types of threats, the types of harassment that I'm sure you can imagine it, but you know, just on the regular, just for having a voice as a woman, you get told to kill yourself. You get told that you're going to get raped. You get told that you're all of these things for the simple fact that you're a woman talking about things that people don't believe you should be talking about.
But you get that same thing on racism too.
It's worse for women of color for sure, because there's more things that people talk to them about. But I think she did the exact right thing for her. And I think her quitting made a better statement than she ever could have done staying in that company. I think it certainly called attention
to the problem far more, because I didn't know about this problem until she called attention to it. Because I don't listen to Global News Radio. I've been on Global News Radio a couple times and won't go back because I'll get to my experiences, but Hafiz wanted to put his two cents worth in, so Hafiz, the coin slot is open.
Look, I mean, as a person of color, especially as a brown guy, and looking at what the information that gets put on sort of Global News and the commentary, I have to say that these companies have kind of given in to that base of assholes. I'm just going to call them that because that's what they are, that put out this vitriol on the internet, and they do not ever call it out, or they kind of dance around it. They let the comments fly. If you look at their Twitter comments on whatnot, Global and organizations like Global have just let it slide. And it's like, hey, well, we can't control what people say or listeners say. Well, you know what? There's guys like Charles Adler that stand up and say, this is wrong and this is not right. And that is important in this day and age. And it is important that organizations, news organizations, I'm not saying police your listeners, but call it out. You know, we're in a society where if someone says something that degree of stupid, you don't just ignore it anymore. You have to call it out. Because if you're not calling it out, you're just letting it be complacent and you're kind of empowering it so that it happens again. Because all we have these days is people of color standing up together against this. And I mean, we have the allies come in here and there, and you know, you'll have a bunch of white women take on the cause of Black Lives Matter, but they don't actually give a flying fuck. When it comes down to it, it's people like in these jobs that face the brunt of the abuse, and that abuse is real. When you get death threats and you're getting stuff like this pop into your inbox and your employer does fuck all, it really says to you how little you fucking matter to them. And in all reality, if this was a different situation, where people were getting death threats, wouldn't that be turned over to the police? Why isn't it turned over to the police? Why doesn't some dickhead from Alberta that likes to shoot out horrible racist comments and death threats not get a knock on his door and say, hey, by the way, you're uttering threats. That's actually an offense. Guess what? You're going to have to show up to court for that, asshole.
Yeah, and given the magnitude of what we've described, of the types of things Ms. Devetti has heard against her and against her family, it would be completely reasonable to expect that type. Like the line that Sam quoted that I won't repeat just boggles the mind. And yeah, if there wasn't a legal response to that, that's a problem in itself. But just looking at the landscape of these types of issues, of racial prejudice issues in the broader context of society, I get very frustrated, like you, Hafiz, about the thin nature of concern over meaningful change on questions of inclusion, particularly from a racial perspective. And if I think back to a few years ago, like I agree with what Sam said, that the intersection of gender and race creates an incredibly poisonous environment for women of color. But if you separate those two issues just for the sake of discussion, if you look at the attention that gender issues got in the Me Too environment versus the attention that racial issues are getting in the Black Lives Matter environment, you see an imbalance of commitment and interest. And I think that it is in at least part a consequence of people's instincts. If, let's be honest, attractive white women celebrities are promoting a cause, they get more public sympathy than women and men, minorities of color. And that's just a reality of life. But if we're actually going to be serious about racial inclusion, we need the same magnitude of meaningful concern that was brought to Me Too 3 years ago to Black Lives Matter now. And if I look at the last 6 months, we saw protests in the streets 6 months ago. We saw people changing their sort of social media images to Black imagery. We saw people using hashtags, but I don't see a lot of change 6 months later compared to the sustained momentum that we saw in the Me Too movement. So I'm really hoping that as a society, we elevate questions of prejudice and racism to the same forefront that we've seen on gender issues, because I think there is a real problem that's going unsolved.
But mind you, the momentum of Me Too has kind of fizzled as well. These things, the problem with these things becoming causes of the month is that they become fashionable, and everything that's fashionable eventually becomes unfashionable. And that's why things like causes about human rights and treating people with dignity should never be a fashion. It should never be a fad. It should be never be anything that fades out. And I think that the reason that people will listen to a white person talk about a cause more than they will a woman or a woman or person of color is that there's this inherent feeling that women and people of color have a chip on their shoulder. And so, yeah, sure, they're complaining. Yeah. They got a chip on their shoulder. As opposed to they have actually legitimate grievances, it's seen as somewhere deep down. I don't think it's a conscious thought. I think somewhere deep down, there's an accepted narrative that people of identifiable groups have chips on their shoulder. So they are always complaining. So why should I listen to this? They're always complaining. Sam?
Yeah, so a response to both of those movements that really, really concerns me. And ultimately, it does come from mostly middle-aged white men of a certain age. Is in the Me Too movement, it was, oh, well, so many men are going to be put under more scrutiny now, and it's going to be unfair, and everyone's going to be accused under Me Too, and things like that.
Which didn't happen.
And the same with race. People were saying that, like, oh, people of color are only focusing on race, and all they see is race, and yada, yada, yada. There's a problem with both of those things, and they're unfortunately very prevalent, is that with Me Too, this wasn't about, like, sticking it to men. It wasn't feminists sticking it to men. I think what they don't realize is just how prevalent these issues were. Unfortunately, Me Too was a reckoning. It wasn't just a fashionable trend. This wasn't a lot of new allegations coming up. This was people feeling empowered to finally talk about what had already happened to them. So for people to dismiss Me Too as like this fashionable thing, oh, let's just talk about Me Too and sticking it to men. No, this was an actual thing where women finally felt safer in this kind of big movement to say, this also happened to me. Whether it's sexual assault or harassment at work or whatever, this was a reckoning. This wasn't finding new dirt on men. This was just trying to show people just how prevalent it was. And the same with these people that you see on social media saying, oh, all these POC journalists and all they see is race. Well, guess what? Yeah. They're people of color. Obviously, race is going to factor into
That's like saying that, you know, these sports reporters, they only report on sports.
Exactly. Like, why wouldn't you want to bring attention to an issue that obviously affects your daily life?
And when your color is thrown in your face all the time, I'm sorry, that is what you see. If at your job, if people treat you based on the color of your skin or your name or something being foreign or your culture or your religion, it adds up. And I mean, it as a person of color and a person that, you know, comes from the Muslim religion, living in Canada, this happens quite a lot in the workplace and beyond. This is the life of a person of color. Your entire life and your existence continuously has to be brought up in just shitty, useless conversations that have no fucking consequence.
And that's the thing. If you compare what Sam has just said and what Hafiz has just said, I agree, Sam. Me Too was a reckoning in its original form, calling out things that were not socially acceptable to talk about. And that reckoning played out in changes to individual instincts and personal behavior. Men, I know I felt this. Hafiz, you and I have talked about this. It really caused some soul searching about personal histories, about what are my instincts that I need to change? Because, yeah, we need to take this type of thing a lot more seriously. I worry that reckoning that we have had on gender issues doesn't mirror itself in the response to Black Lives Matter and to racial protests. Because in a lot of cases, and I think about my personal circles, both recently and also thinking back to the workplace, the people who will say, I care about these issues, when you call them out on their personal behaviors, they get really defensive and they start questioning. I call this on social media Vigneault's vanity, because if you look at Alain Vigneault, the head coach of the Philadelphia Flyers, when he was called out on being tone deaf for his response to Black Lives Matter, the speech that he gave the next day was entirely a defense of his personal honor, which I found offensive. And that's the type of thing which in the Me Too environment, if he'd done that on gender issues, he would have been publicly crucified. But on racial issues, it's more acceptable to go defensive when you are personally called out to try to disconnect yourself from the problem. And if you look at how racial issues sort of become prevalent through society and maintained through society, it's that disconnect between concern on an abstract group level without holding yourself accountable. So the word that Sam used, I really like it. It's reckoning. I'm looking forward to seeing that on racial issues in the same way that we've seen on gender, because I don't think it's playing out with the same level of seriousness.
And I'll say this about media, especially talk radio stations, conservative talk radio stations, yeah, they'll say they support Black Lives Matter and blah, 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 blah. But the truth is, I think that there's a tremendous amount of cynicism there, because they know that their continued existence relies, their lifeblood are intolerant assholes. They know that their audience are intolerant assholes. And so as much as they may even personally find some of these things repugnant, they look at the bottom line and say, if we actually clean this up, we're going to go the way of the dinosaur. So I think that while they make the right cover, they use the right camouflage in comments or contributions to causes or so on, they know deep down that they could very well. I mean, the host of a show really sets the tone as to what the kind of callers you're going to get and the kind of callers that you hang up on. Sets the tone for the kind of callers you're going to get. You basically set the tone for your community and your audience. And I think a lot of these people, either they themselves are radical conservatives and don't give a rat's ass and see some kind of communist plot and George Soros behind everything, or else they just look at it and say, well, I know where my bread is buttered. These lunatics, these intolerant lunatics, they're the people buttering my bread. And so I think that there is a reluctance, whether on a conscious level, whether it's ever spoken out loud, I don't know. But I think that there is a gut level realization that if they clean things up, they're going to wind up with lower listenership. And radio is already treading water and taking on water as it's treading to try to stay alive and relevant.
I'm sorry, but if you're going to build your business around assholes, sooner or later, you're just going to be left with a pile of shit. And that's where you're at.
That is a very interesting bit of metaphor, and I think a great place for us to end. Thank you for that, Hafiz. It's very, very
you're
visual.
Very welcome.
If you build your business on assholes, you're going to be left with a pile of shit. All right. That's almost Mark Twain in his qualities. So thank you very much for that. And thanks to all of the panel today. Aaron Seal in Montreal, thank you for your contributions. Thanks for coming back this week.
Always a pleasure.
Hafiz Noorani in Vancouver, thank you for your contributions.
Thank you for having me.
And Sam Eamon, of course, as always, thank you for your participation and your your passionate insights and commentary.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And to all of you, if you like this show, $5. That's it, $5. We're asking you to give $5 to our either our PayPal or our Patreon. Patreon makes you a member of the team, which means that every month you're giving us $5 to keep doing this show, which comes down to $1.25 a week. Come on, that's peanuts, and you know you have it handy. So Patreon is patreon.com/FUNetworkTV, and PayPal is funetworktv@gmail.com. Come on, I know you got the $5. If you don't, no shame. Honest to God, continue to enjoy for free. But if you got the money, quit being a freeloader. And that's it. I'm Ed DeSock. This has been Sock It to Politics on the Fun Network.